Interlude. One story. We've spent quite a while thinking about specific tasks involved in the activity of reading, such as considering how this means X, that signifies Y, and so on. Now, of course, I believe this and that and X and Y matter, and on some level, so do you, else we would not be at this point in our discussion. But there's a greater truth, at least as I see it, behind all these specific interpretive activities. A truth that informs and drives the creation of novels and plays and stories and poems and essays and memoirs, even when, as is usually the case, writers aren't aware of it. I've mentioned it before and have employed it throughout, so it's no very great secret. Moreover, it's not my personal invention or discovery, so I'm not looking for credit here, but it needs saying again. So here it is. There's only one story. One story. Everywhere. Always. Wherever anyone puts pen to paper, or hands to keyboard, or fingers to lute string, or quill to papyrus, they all take from and in return give to the same story, ever since Snorg got back to the cave and told Ankh about the mastodon that got away. Norse sagas, Samoan creation stories, Gravity's Rainbow, the tale of Genji, Hamlet, last year's graduation speech, last week's Dave Barry column, On the Road and Road to Rio and The Road Not Taken, one story. What's it about? That's probably the best question you'll ever ask, and I apologize for responding with a really lame answer. I don't know. It's not about anything. It's about everything. It's not about something, the way an elegy is about the death of a young friend, for instance, or the way the Maltese Falcon is about solving the mystery of the fat man and the black bird. It's about everything that anyone wants to write about. I suppose what the one story, the story, is about is ourselves. About what it means to be human. I mean, what else is there? When Stephen Hawking writes A Brief History of Time, what is he doing except telling us what home is like, describing the place where we live? You see, being human takes in just about everything, since we want to know about space and time and this world and the next, questions I'm pretty sure none of my English setters have ever really pondered. Mostly, though, we're interested in ourselves in space or time, in the world. So what our poets and storytellers do for us, drag a rock up to the fire, have a seat, listen to this one, is explain us and the world, or us in the world. Do writers know this? Do they think about it? A. Good heavens, no. B. Absolutely, yes. C. Let me try again. On one level, everyone who writes anything knows that pure originality is impossible. Everywhere you look, the ground is already camped on. So you sigh and pitch your tent where you can, knowing someone else has been there before. Think of it this way. Can you use a word no one else has ever used? Only if you're Shakespeare or Joyce and coin words, but even they mostly use the same ones as the rest of us. Can you put together a combination of words that is absolutely unique? Maybe occasionally, but you can't be sure. So too with stories. John Barth discusses an Egyptian papyrus complaining that all the stories have been told, and that therefore nothing remains for the contemporary writer but to retell them. That papyrus, describing the postmodern condition, is 4,500 years old. This is not a terrible thing, though. Writers notice all the time that their characters resemble somebody. Persephone, Pip, Long John Silver, La Belle Dame Sans Merci, and they go with it. What happens if the writer is good is usually not that the work seems derivative or trivial, but just the opposite. The work actually acquires depth and resonance from the echoes and chimes it sets up with prior texts, weight from the accumulated use of certain basic patterns and tendencies. Moreover, works are actually more comforting because we recognize elements in them from our prior reading. I suspect that a wholly original work, one that owed nothing to previous writing, would so lack familiarity as to be quite unnerving to readers. So that's one answer. But here's another. Writers also have to practice a kind of amnesia when they sit down, Or, like Thomas Wolfe, who was very tall and wrote on top of the refrigerator, really, stand up to write. The downside of the weight of millennia of accumulated practice of any activity is that it's very heavy. I once psyched out a teammate in an over-30 men's basketball league quite by accident. We were practicing free throws before a game when something occurred to me, and like an idiot, I couldn't keep it to myself. "Lee, have you ever considered," I asked, "how many things can go wrong when you shoot a free throw?" He literally stopped in mid-shot to offer his view. "Damn you," he said. "Now I won't make one all night." He was right. Had I known I could have that kind of effect, I'd have warmed up with the other team. Now consider Lee's problem if he had to consider not merely all the biomechanics of shooting a basketball, but the whole history of free throw shooting. You know, not too much like Lenny Wilkins, a bit of Dave Bing, some of Rick Barry, before he switched to the two-handed underhand shot, plenty of Larry Bird, but don't plagiarize him outright, none at all of Wilt Chamberlain. What are the chances any of us would ever make a free throw? And basketball only dates back about one century. Now, consider trying to write a lyric poem with everyone from Sappho to Tennyson to Frost to Plath to Verlaine to Lee Poe looking over your shoulder. That's a lot of hot breath on the back of your neck. So, amnesia. When the writer gets to work, she has to shut out the voices and write what she writes, say what she has to say. What the unremembering trick does is clear out this history from the front of her mind so her own poem can come in. While she may never, or very rarely, think at all about these matters consciously, she's been reading poetry since she was 6, when Aunt Tilly gave her Robert Louis Stevenson's A Child's Garden of Verses, burns through a couple of volumes of poetry a week, has read most of Wallace Stevens 6 or 7 times. In other words, the history of poetry never leaves her. It's always present, a gigantic subconscious database of poetry, and fiction, since she's read that too. You know by now, I like to keep things fairly simple. I'm no fan of the latest French theory or of jargon of any stripe, but sometimes we really can't do without it. What I'm talking about here involves a couple of concepts we need to consider. The first, as I mentioned a few chapters back, is intertextuality. This highly ungainly word denoting a most useful notion comes to us from the great Russian formalist critic Mikhail Bakhtin, who limits it pretty much to fiction. But I think I'll follow the example of T.S. Eliot, who, being a poet, saw that it operates throughout the realms of literature. The basic premise of intertextuality is really pretty simple. Everything's connected. In other words, anything you write is connected to other written things. Sometimes writers are more upfront about it than others, openly showing, as John Fowles does in The French Lieutenant's Woman, that he's drawing on the tradition of the Victorian novel, and on the works of Thomas Hardy and Henry James in particular. At one point, Fowles writes an especially Jamesian sentence, full of embedded clauses, false starts, delayed effects, until, having thoroughly and delightfully aped the master, he declares, "But I must not ape the master." We get the joke, and the punchline makes the parody better than if he'd pretended he was up to nothing very special, since it says with a wink that we're in on the whole thing, that we knew all along. Other writers pretend their work is completely their own, untutored, immediate, unaffected. Mark Twain claimed never to have read a book, yet his personal library ran to something over 3,000 volumes. You can't write A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, 1889, without being familiar with Arthurian romances. Jack Kerouac presents himself as a free spirit performing automatic writing, but there's a lot of evidence that this Ivy Leaguer, Columbia, did a lot of revising and polishing and reading of Quest tales before his manuscript of On the Road, 1957, got typed on one long roll of paper. In each case, their work interacts with other works, and those works with others. The result is a sort of worldwide web of writing. Your novel may contain echoes or refutations of novels or poems you've never read. Think of intertextuality in terms of movie westerns. You're writing your first western. Good for you. What's it about? A big showdown? High Noon. A gunslinger who retires? Shane. A lonely outpost during an uprising? Fort Apache. She wore a yellow ribbon. The woods are full of them. Cattle drive? Red River. Does it involve, by any chance, a stagecoach? No, wait, I wasn't thinking about any of them. Doesn't matter. Your movie will. Here's the thing. You can't avoid them. Since even avoidance is a form of interaction, it's simply impossible to write or direct in a vacuum. The movies you have seen were created by men and women who had seen others, and so on, until every movie connects with every other movie ever made. If you've seen Indiana Jones being dragged behind a truck by his whip, then you've been touched by The Cisco Kid, 1931, even though there's a strong chance you've never seen The Cisco Kid itself. Every Western has a little bit of other Westerns in it, whether it knows it or not. Let's take the most basic element, the hero. Will your hero talk a lot or not? If not, then he's in the tradition of Gary Cooper and John Wayne, and later, Clint Eastwood. If he does speak, just talks his fool head right off, then he's like James Garner and those revisionist films of the 60s and 70s. Or maybe you have two, one talker and one silent type. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, 1969. Your guy is going to have a certain amount of dialogue, and whatever type you decide on, audiences are going to hear echoes of some prior film, whether you think those echoes are there or not. And that, dear friends, is intertextuality. The second concept for our consideration is archetype. The late, great Canadian critic Northrop Frye took the notion of archetypes from C.G. Jung's psychoanalytical writings and showed that whatever Jung can tell us about our heads, he can tell us a great deal more about our books. Archetype is a $5 word for pattern, or for the mythic original on which a pattern is based. It's like this. Somewhere back in myth, something, a story component, let's call it, comes into being. It works so well, for one reason or another, that it catches on, hangs around, and keeps popping up in subsequent stories. That component could be anything, a quest, a form of sacrifice, flight, a plunge into water, whatever resonates and catches our imaginations, setting off vibrations deep in our collective consciousness, calling to us, alarming us, inspiring us to dream or nightmare, making us want to hear it again, and again, and again, and again. You'd think that these components, these archetypes, would wear out with use the way cliché wears out. But they actually work the other way. They take on power with repetition, finding strength in numbers. Here is the aha factor again. When we hear or see or read one of these instances of archetype, we feel a little frisson of recognition and utter a little satisfied aha, and we get that chance with fair frequency, because writers keep employing them. Don't bother looking for the originals, though. You can't find the archetype, just as you can't find the pure myths. What we have, even in our earliest recorded literature, are variants, embellishments, versions, what Frye called displacement of the myth. We can never get all the way to the level of pure myth, even when a work like The Lord of the Rings or The Odyssey or The Old Man and the Sea feels mythic, since even those works are displacements of myth. Perhaps it's impossible. Perhaps there never has been a single definite version of the myth. Frye thought the archetypes came from the Bible, or so he said at times, but such a notion won't account for the myths and archetypes that lie behind and inform the works of Homer, say, or those of any storyteller or poet who lacked access to the Judeo-Christian tradition. So let's say that somewhere back there in the mists of time when storytelling was completely oral, or pictorial if you count the cave walls, a body of myth began establishing itself. The unanswerable question, it seems to me, is whether there was ever freestanding myth informing our stories, or whether the mythic level grows out of the stories that we tell to explain ourselves and our world. In other words, was there some original master story for any particular myth from which all subsequent stories, pallid imitations, are displacements? Or does the myth take shape by slow accretion as variant story versions are told and retold over time? I incline toward the latter. but I don't know. In fact, I doubt anyone can know. I also doubt whether it matters. What does matter is that there is this mythic level, the level on which archetype operates, and from which we borrow the figure of, for instance, the dying and reviving man, or God, or the young boy who must undertake a long journey. Those stories, myth, archetype, religious narrative, the great body of literature, are always with us, always in us. We can draw upon them, tap into them, add to them whenever we want. One of our great storytellers, country singer Willie Nelson, was sitting around one day just noodling on the guitar, improvising melodies he'd never written down, never heard in quite those forms. His companion, a non-musician whose name I forget, asked him how he could come up with all those tunes. "They're all around us," old Willie said. "You just reach up and pick them out of the air." Stories are like that too. That one story that has been going on forever is all around us. We, as readers or writers, tellers or listeners, understand each other. We share knowledge of the structures of our myths. We comprehend the logic of symbols, largely because we have access to the same swirl of story. We have only to reach out into the air and pluck a piece of it. Chapter 21. Marked for Greatness. Quasimodo is a hunchback. So is Richard III, Shakespeare's, not history's. Mary Shelley's better-known creation, not Victor Frankenstein, but his monster, is a man of parts. Oedipus has damaged feet, and Grendel, well, he is another monster. All characters who are as famous for their shape as for their behavior. Their shapes tell us something, and probably very different somethings, about them or other people in the story. First, the obvious but nonetheless necessary observation. In real life, when people have any physical mark or imperfection, it means nothing thematically, metaphorically, or spiritually. Well, a scar on your cheek might tell us something if you got it as a member of a dueling fraternity at Heidelberg, and certain self-inflicted marks, Grateful Dead tattoos, for instance, might say something about your musical tastes. But by and large, a short leg is just a short leg, and scoliosis is just scoliosis. But put that scoliosis on Richard III and voila, you have something else entirely. Richard, as morally and spiritually twisted as his back, is one of the most completely repugnant figures in all of literature. And while it might strike us as cruel and unjust to equate physical deformity with character or moral deformity, it seemed not only acceptable to the Elizabethans, but almost inevitable. Shakespeare is very much a product of his time in suggesting that one's proximity to or distance from God is manifested in external signs. The Puritans, only a few years after him, saw failure in business, ruined crops, bankruptcy, financial mismanagement, even disease in one's herd, as clear evidence of God's displeasure, and therefore of moral shortcomings. Evidently, the story of Job didn't play in Plymouth. Right. The Elizabethans and Jacobeans weren't politically correct. So now what, you ask? Meaning, what about 4 centuries later? Things have changed pretty dramatically in terms of equating scars or deformities with moral shortcomings or divine displeasure, but in literature, we continue to understand physical imperfection in symbolic terms. It has to do with being different, really. Sameness doesn't present us with metaphorical possibilities, whereas difference, from the average, the typical, the expected, is always rich with possibility. Vladimir Propp, in his landmark study of folktales back in the 1920s, Morphology of the Folktale, separates the story of the folk quester into 30 or so separate steps. One of the initial steps is that the hero is marked in some way. He may be scarred or lamed or wounded or painted or born with a short leg, but he bears some mark that sets him apart. The tales Propp looks at go back hundreds of years and have scores of variants, and while they happen to be Slavic in origin, structurally, they resemble the Germanic, Celtic, French, and Italian folk tales better known in the West. Many of those tales continue to inform our understanding of how stories are told. You doubt? How many stories do you know in which the hero is different from everyone else in some way, and how many times is that difference physically visible? Why does Harry Potter have a scar? Where is it? How did he get it? And what does it resemble? Consider the ways Toni Morrison marks her characters. One quester, our old friend Milkman Dead from Song of Solomon, bears an initial marking, one leg being shorter than the other. He spends much of his youth adopting ways of walking that will hide his deficiency as he perceives it. Later, he will be scarred twice, once on his cheek by a beer bottle in a fight in Shalimar, Virginia, and once on his hands when his former pal Guitar tries to garrote him and Milkman gets his hands up just in time. In Beloved, Sethi has been whipped so severely in her past that she wears elaborate scars resembling a tree on her back. Her mother-in-law and mentor, Baby Suggs, has a bad hip, and Beloved herself is perfect except for three scratches on her forehead. On the other hand, Beloved is something else again, not merely human. These character markings stand as indicators of the damage life inflicts. In the case of Sethi and Beloved, that life involves slavery, so the violence that marks them is of a very specific sort. But even the others bear signs illustrating the way life marks all who pass through it. Beyond that, though, is another element, character differentiation. At the end of Sophocles' Oedipus Rex, the king blinds himself, which is very definitely a kind of marking of atonement, guilt, and contrition, and one that he will wear throughout the subsequent play, Oedipus at Colonus. But he was marked much, much earlier. In fact, being good Greeks, we knew this before we arrived at the theater, just from the meaning of the name, Oedipus, Wounded Foot. If we were headed to the theater to watch a play called Wounded Foot the King, which is what that title means, we'd already know something was up. The oddity of the name, the way it calls attention to a physical problem, suggests that this aspect of his identity will come into play. Indeed, Oedipus's feet are damaged from the thong that was put through his Achilles tendons when, as an infant, he was sent away to die in the wilderness. His parents, fearing the terrible prophecy that he would kill his father and marry his mother, have him taken out to the country to be killed. Knowing how hard it will be for their servant to be the agent of death, they intend for the infant to be left on a mountain where he will perish of exposure. Just to be safe, they cause his feet to be lashed together so he doesn't get up and crawl away. Later, his feet will become a piece of evidence proving that he is, in fact, the doomed infant. You might think that his mother, Jocasta, would be well advised either A, never to remarry, or B, to avoid marrying anyone with damaged ankles, but she chooses option C instead, thereby providing us with a plot. Quite lucky for Sophocles, if catastrophic for poor Oedipus. His scars speak of his personal history, which of course is hidden from him until it is revealed during the course of the play. Moreover, they address the personality of his parents, especially Jocasta, who tried to elude the curse, and of Oedipus himself, who seems never to have inquired as to how he came to have these scars. This lack of inquisitiveness is diagnostic, since the basis of his downfall is his inability to know himself. Something more modern? Sure. Ernest Hemingway. The Sun Also Rises. Modern enough? The novel, which deals with a generation that was damaged in so many ways by World War I, is an ironic reworking of the wasteland motif. Like T.S. Eliot's poetic masterpiece, The Wasteland, it presents a society that has been rendered barren, spiritually, morally, intellectually, and sexually, by the war. Such a treatment is not at all surprising, given the death and destruction of millions of young, virile males. Traditionally, the wasteland myth concerns the struggle, the quest to restore fertility. This quest is undertaken by or on behalf of the Fisher King, a character who exhibits physical damage in many versions. That's the original. Hemingway's Fisher King? Jake Barnes, newspaper correspondent and wounded war veteran. How do we know he's the Fisher King? He goes fishing. Actually, his fishing trip is quite extensive and, in its own way, restorative. It is also highly symbolic. And what you ask is the wound that makes him right for the role? This is tricky, since Jake, who narrates, never says. There's only one thing, though, that can make a grown man, looking at himself in the mirror, weep. In real life, Hemingway's own wound was in the upper thigh. In the novel, he moved it just north. Poor Jake. All the sexual desire and none of the ability to act upon it. So what's going on here? Character differentiation, certainly. The missing member sets Jake apart from everyone else in the novel, or any other novel I know of, for that matter. It also sets up parallels to the operative wasteland myth. Perhaps a touch of Isis and Osiris thrown in. Osiris was torn apart, and the goddess Isis succeeded in reassembling him except for the part that makes Jake Barnes resemble him. The Osiris myth is an Egyptian fertility myth. Priestesses of Isis took human lovers as symbolical stand-ins for the damaged Osiris, not unlike the way Lady Brett Ashley in the novel takes other lovers because she and Jake cannot consummate their passion. But chiefly the injury is symbolic of the destruction of possibilities, spiritual as well as procreative, accomplished by the war. When millions of young men die in war, they take with them not merely reproductive possibilities, but also tremendous intellectual, creative, and artistic resources. The war was, in short, the death of culture, or at least of a very great chunk of it. Moreover, those who survived, like Hemingway and his characters, were badly damaged from the experience. The Great War generation probably suffered greater psychic damage and spiritual displacement than any other in history. Hemingway captures that damage three times over. Once in the Nick Adams stories culminating in Big Two-Hearted River, 1925, where Nick goes off alone to Michigan's then remote Upper Peninsula on a fishing trip to repair his broken psyche after the horrors of his war experience. A second in Jake Barnes's war wound and the fractured festivities in Pamplona, and a third in Lieutenant Frederick Henry's separate peace, broken by his lover's death in childbirth in A Farewell to Arms. All three cover the same ground of mental damage, spiritual despair, the death of hope. Jake's wounding, then, is personal, historical, cultural, mythic. That's a lot of impact for one little piece of shrapnel. In his Alexandria Quartet, Lawrence Durrell introduces numerous characters with disabilities and deformities of various sorts. Two with eye patches, although one is faking it, and one with a glass eye, one with a hair lip, one who contracts smallpox and is badly scarred, one whose hand, impaled by an accidental spear gun shot, must be amputated to save her life, one who is deaf, and several with limbs missing. On one level, being Durrell characters, they are simply versions of the exotic. Yet collectively, they come to represent something else. Everyone, Durrell seems to be saying, is damaged in some way or other. And no matter how careful or fortunate we might seem to be, we don't get through life without being marked by the experience. Interestingly enough, his damaged characters are not particularly incommoded by their deficiencies. The hair-lipped Nafuz becomes a celebrated mystic and preacher, while Clea, the painter, reports late in the final novel that her prosthetic hand can paint. The gift lies not in her hand, in other words, but in her heart, her mind, her soul. What's Mary Shelley up to, then? Her monster doesn't carry the specific historical baggage of a Jake Barnes, so what does his deformity represent? Let's look at where he comes from. Victor Frankenstein builds his spare parts masterpiece not only out of a graveyard, but also out of a specific historical situation. The Industrial Revolution was just starting up, and this new world would threaten everything people had known during the Enlightenment. At the same time, the new science and the new faith in science, including anatomical research, of course, imperiled many religious and philosophical tenets of English society in the first decades of the 19th century. Thanks to Hollywood, the monster looks like Boris Karloff or Lon Chaney and intimidates us by its sheer physical menace. But in the novel, it's the idea of the monster that is frightening. Or perhaps it's really the idea of the man, the scientist sorcerer, forging an unholy alliance with dark knowledge that scares us. The monster represents, among other things, forbidden insights, a modern pact with the devil, the result of science without ethics. You don't need me to tell you this, naturally. Every time there's an advance in the state of knowledge, a movement into a brave new world, another literary reference, of course, some commentator or other informs us that we're closer to meeting a Frankenstein, meaning, of course, the monster. The monster has several other possible frames of reference. The most obvious literary angle is the Faustian pact with the devil. We keep getting versions of Faust, from Christopher Marlowe's Dr. Faustus to Goethe's Faust to Stephen Vincent Benet's The Devil and Daniel Webster to Damned Yankees to movie versions of Bedazzled and, of course, Darth Vader's turn to the dark side to bluesman Robert Johnson's stories of how he acquired his musical skill in a meeting with a mysterious stranger at a crossroads. The enduring appeal of this cautionary tale suggests how deeply embedded it is in our collective consciousness. Unlike other versions, however, Frankenstein involves no demonic personage offering the damning bargain, so the cautionary being is the product, the monster, rather than the source, the devil, of the unholy act. In his deformity, he projects the perils of man seeking to play God, perils that, as in other non-comic versions, consume the power seeker. Beyond these cautionary elements, though, the real monster is Victor, the monster's maker, or at least a portion of him. Romanticism gave us the notion, rampant throughout the 19th century and still with us in the 21st, of the dual nature of humanity, that in each of us, no matter how well made or socially groomed, a monstrous other exists. The concept explains the fondness for doubles and self-contained others in Victorian fiction, The Prince and the Pauper, 1882, The Master of Ballantrae, The Picture of Dorian Gray, 1891, and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Significantly, these last two also involve hideous others, the portrait of Dorian that reveals his corruption and decay, while he himself remains beautiful, and the monstrous Mr. Hyde, into whom the good doctor turns when he drinks the fateful elixir. What they share with Shelley's monster is the implication that within each of us, no matter how civilized, lurk elements that we'd really prefer not to acknowledge, the exact opposite of The Hunchback of Notre Dame or Beauty and the Beast, where a hideous outer form hides the beauty of the inner person. Are deformities and scars therefore always significant? Perhaps not. Perhaps sometimes a scar is simply a scar, a short leg, or a hunchback, merely that. But more often than not, physical markings by their very nature call attention to themselves and signify some psychological or thematic point the writer wants to make. After all, it's easier to introduce characters without imperfections. You give a guy a limp in chapter 2, he can't go sprinting after the train in chapter 24. So if a writer brings up a physical problem or handicap or deficiency, he probably means something by it. Now, go figure out Harry Potter's scar. Chapter 22. He's blind for a reason, you know. Here's the setup. You have a man, a largely admirable man, capable, intelligent, strong, if slightly quick to anger, with a problem. Unbeknownst to him, he has committed the two most hideous crimes in the human catalog of evil. So unaware is he of his sins that he agrees to hunt down the criminal, promising all kinds of punishment. An information specialist, someone who can shed light on the search he has undertaken, who can show our hero the truth, is summoned. When the specialist arrives, he's blind, can't see a thing in the world. As it turns out, though, he is able to see things in the spirit and divine world, can see the truth of what's actually happened, truth to which our hero is utterly oblivious. The blind specialist gets into a heated argument with the protagonist, who accuses the specialist of fraud, and is accused in turn of being the worst sort of malefactor, one who, by the way, is blind to what really matters. What did this fellow do? Nothing much. Just murder his father and marry his mother. 2.5 millennia ago, Sophocles wrote a little play called Oedipus Rex. Tiresias, the blind seer, does indeed know the whole truth about King Oedipus, sees everything, although that knowledge is so painful that he tries to hold it back. And when he does blurt it out, it is in a moment of such anger that no one believes him. Oedipus, meanwhile, who until the very end remains in the dark, makes constant reference to sight. He will bring the matter to light, will look into things, will show everyone the truth. Every time he says one of these things, the audience gasps and squirms in its seats, because we see what's going on long before he does. When he finally sees the horror that is his life, children who are also siblings, a wife, mother, driven to suicide, a curse like no other on him and his family, he exacts a terrible punishment indeed. He blinds himself. There are a lot of things that have to happen when a writer introduces a blind character into a story, and even more in a play. Every move, every statement by or about that character has to accommodate the lack of sight. Every other character has to notice, to behave differently, if only in subtle ways. In other words, the author has created a minor constellation of difficulties for himself by introducing a blind character into the work. So something important must be at stake when blindness pops up in a story. Clearly, the author wants to emphasize other levels of sight and blindness beyond the physical. Moreover, such references are usually quite pervasive in a work where insight and blindness are at issue. For example, first-time readers or viewers will observe that Tiresias is blind but sees the real story, and Oedipus is blind to the truth and eventually blinds himself. What they may miss, though, is the much more elaborate pattern running through the fabric of the play. Every scene, it seems, every ode by the chorus, contains references to seeing. Who saw what? Who failed to see? Who is really blind? And images of light and darkness, which have everything to do with seeing or not seeing. More than any other work, Oedipus Rex taught me how to read literary blindness. Taught me that as soon as we notice blindness and sight as thematic components of a work, more and more related images and phrases emerge in the text. The challenging thing about literature is finding answers, but equally important is recognizing what questions need to be asked, and if we pay attention, the text usually tells us. I didn't always know to look for the right questions. I grew into asking. Coming back to blindness, I distinctly remember the first time I read James Joyce's little story, Araby. The first line tells us that the street the young narrator lives on is blind. I thought, that's an odd expression. I promptly got hung up on what it meant in the literal sense. A blind alley in British/Irish English is a dead-end street, which has another set of connotations, some related and some not, and missed entirely what it really meant. I got most of the story. The boy watching the girl at every opportunity, even when the light is poor or he has the blinds, I'm not making this up, pulled almost all the way down. The boy blinded by love, then by vanity, the boy envisioning himself as a hero out of a romance, the boy going to the supposedly exotic bazaar Araby, arriving late to find much of it already in darkness, registering it as the tawdry and anti-romantic place that it is, and finally, the boy, nearly blinded by his own angry tears, seeing himself for the ridiculous creature he is. I think I had to read the story two more times before I got hooked into North Richmond Street being blind. The significance of that adjective isn't immediately evident or relevant in itself. What it does, though, is set up a pattern of reference and suggestion as the young boy watches, hides, peeks, and gazes his way through a story that is alternately bathed in light and lost in shadow. Once we ask the right question, something like, what does Joyce intend by calling the street blind? Answers begin presenting themselves with considerable regularity. A truly great story or play, as Araby and Oedipus Rex are, makes demands on us as readers. In a sense, it teaches us how to read it. We feel that there's something more going on in the story, a richness, a resonance, a depth, than we picked up at first. So we return to it to find those elements that account for that sensation. Periodically throughout this book, I have felt obliged to issue disclaimers. This is one of those times. What we have discussed is absolutely true. When literal blindness, sight, darkness, and light are introduced into a story, it is nearly always the case that figurative seeing and blindness are at work. Here's the caveat. Seeing and blindness are generally at issue in many works, even when there is no hint of blindness on the part of windows, alleys, horses, speculations, or persons. If it's there all the time, what's the point of introducing it specifically into some stories? Good question. I think it's a matter of shading and subtlety, and their opposite. It's a little like music, I suppose. Do you get all those musical jokes in Mozart and Haydn? Well, neither do I. The closest I came to classical music in my youth was Procol Harum ripping off a Bach cantata for A Whiter Shade of Pale. Eventually, I learned a little, including the difference between Beethoven and Roll Over Beethoven, even if I prefer the latter, and between Miles Davis and John Coltrane at their peak, but I remain a musical numbskull. Those subtle jokes for the musical initiates are lost on an ignoramus such as myself. So if you want me to get the point musically, you'd better be fairly obvious. I get Keith Emerson better than I get Bach, any Bach, and some of the Bachs aren't that subtle. Same with literature. If writers want us, all of us, to notice something, they'd better put it out there where we'll find it. Please observe that in most works where blindness is manifest, the writer brings it up pretty early. I call this the Indiana Jones principle. If you want your audience to know something important about your character or the work at large, introduce it early, before you need it. Say we're 2/3 of the way through Raiders of the Lost Ark, and suddenly Indy, who has heretofore been afraid of absolutely nothing, is terrified of snakes. Do we buy that? Of course not. That's why Steven Spielberg, the director, and Lawrence Kasdan, the writer, installed that snake in the airplane right in the first sequence before the credits, so that when we get to the 7,000 snakes, we'll know just how badly they frighten our hero. The principle doesn't always work, of course. In his absurdist dramatic masterpiece, Waiting for Godot, 1954, about which, more later, Samuel Beckett waits until the second act to introduce a blind character. The first time Lucky and Pozzo show up to relieve the boredom of Dee Dee and Gogo, the main characters, Pozzo is a cruel master who keeps Lucky on a leash. The second time, he's blind and needs Lucky to escort him around, although he's no less cruel for all that. Of course, what this means is up for grabs, since Beckett is employing irony, and not very subtly. More commonly, though, the blind character will show up early. In Henry Green's first novel, Blindness, 1926, his schoolboy protagonist is blinded by a freak accident when a small boy throws a rock through a railway carriage window. John, the schoolboy, has just begun to see life's possibilities, and at that moment in his life, a rock and 1,000 shards of glass come sailing in to rob him of that vision. Back to Oedipus. Don't feel too bad. When we meet him again in Oedipus at Colonus, it's many years later, and of course he suffered greatly, but that suffering has redeemed him in the eyes of the gods, and rather than being a blight on the human landscape, he becomes a favorite of the gods, who welcome him into the next world with a miraculous death. He has acquired a level of vision he never had when he was sighted. Blind as he is, he walks toward that death without assistance, as if guided by an unseen power. Chapter 23. It's Never Just Heart Disease. One of my very favorite novels is a gem of narrative misdirection by Ford Madox Ford called The Good Soldier, 1915. Its narrator is more fallible, more consistently clueless than any narrator you're ever likely to meet in all of fiction. At the same time, he's completely believable and therefore pathetic. He is part of a pair of couples who meet every year at a European spa. During all these years, and quite unbeknownst to him, his wife, Florence, and the husband of the other couple, Edward Ashburnham, carry on a passionate affair. It gets better. Edward's wife, Leonora, knows all about it, and in fact may have stage-managed its beginning to keep the chronically straying Edward out of a more disastrous relationship. The success of this strategy must be questioned, since the relationship eventually manages to destroy, by my count, 6 lives. Only poor, cuckolded old John Dowell remains ignorant. Consider the possibilities for irony. For an English professor, and for any avid reader, having a blithely ignorant and only recently clued-in husband narrate the saga of his wife's longtime infidelity is about as good as it gets. But I digress. Why, you ask, are they habitués of the spa? Florence and Edward are ill, of course. Heart trouble. What else? In literature, there is no better, no more lyrical, no more perfectly metaphorical illness than heart disease. In real life, heart disease is none of the above. It's frightening, sudden, shattering, exhausting, but not lyrical or metaphorical. When the novelist or playwright employs it, however, we don't complain that he's being unrealistic or insensitive. Why? It's fairly straightforward. Aside from being the pump that keeps us alive, the heart is also, and has been since ancient times, the symbolic repository of emotion. In both the Iliad and the Odyssey, Homer has characters say of other characters that they have a heart of iron, iron being the newest and hardest metal known to man of the late Bronze Age. The meaning, if we allow for some slight variations of context, is tough-minded, resolute, even to the point of hard-heartedness. In other words, just what we might mean by the same statements today. Sophocles uses the heart to mean the center of emotion within the body, as do Dante, Shakespeare, Donne, Marvel, Hallmark, all the great writers. Despite this nearly constant use over at least 2,800 years, the figure of the heart never overstays its welcome, because it always is welcome. Writers use it because we feel it. What shapes were your Valentine's cards in when you were a kid? Or last year, for that matter? When we fall in love, we feel it in our hearts. When we lose a love, we feel heartbroken. When overwhelmed by strong emotion, we feel our hearts are full to bursting. Everybody knows this. Everybody intuitively senses this. What, then, can the writer do with this knowledge? The writer can use heart ailments as a kind of shorthand for the character, which is probably what happens most often, or he can use it as a social metaphor. The afflicted character can have any number of problems for which heart disease provides a suitable emblem. Bad love, loneliness, cruelty, pederasty, disloyalty, cowardice, lack of determination. Socially, it may stand for these matters on a larger scale, or for something seriously amiss at the heart of things. We're not just talking classic literature here. When Colin Dexter decides to kill off his recurrent Detective Morse in The Remorseful Day, 1999, he has a number of options. The Chief Inspector is a genius at solving crimes and crossword puzzles, but like all geniuses, he has flaws. Specifically, he drinks too much, and remains a complete stranger to physical fitness, so much so that in novel after novel, his Thames Valley police superiors mention his excessive fondness for the beer. His liver and digestive system are seriously compromised, to the point where he is hospitalized for these problems in a previous Morse novel. In fact, he solves a century-old murder from his hospital bed in The Wench is Dead, 1989. His major problem, though, is loneliness. Morse has spectacularly bad luck with his women. Several wind up as either corpses or culprits in his various adventures, while others just don't work out. Sometimes he's too needy, other times too unbending, but time after time he loses out. So when the time comes for him to collapse amid the spires of his beloved Oxford University, Dexter gives him a heart attack. Why? We're into the realm of speculation here, but this is how it strikes me. To have Morse succumb to cirrhosis of the liver turns the whole thing into a straightforward piece of moralizing. See, we told you drinking too much is bad for you. Morse's drinking would go from being a quaint idiosyncrasy to something from one of those old school guidance films, and that is not what Dexter wants. Of course, excessive drinking is bad for you. Excessive anything, including irony, is bad for you. But that's not the point. But with a heart attack, the connection to an over-fondness for drink is still there, if that's what some readers want to see. But now the ailment points not toward his behavior, but toward the pain and suffering, the loneliness and regret of his sad sack love life that may well be causing the behavior. The emphasis is on his humanity, not his misdeeds. And authors, as a rule, are chiefly interested in their character's humanity. Even when the humanity isn't very humane, or the heart ailment a disease, Nathaniel Hawthorne has a great short story called The Man of Adamant, 1837. As with a number of his characters, the man of the title is a committed misanthrope, absolutely convinced that everyone else is a sinner. So he moves into a cave to avoid all human contact. Does it sound like a heart problem to you? Of course it does. Now the limestone cave he chooses has water, a little drip of water that's just stiff with calcium. And moment by moment, year by year, the water in that cave seeps its way into his body, so that at the end of the story, he turns to stone. Or not him entirely, just his heart. The man whose heart was figurative stone at the outset has his heart turned to literal stone at the end. It's perfect. Or take the case of Joseph Conrad's Lord Jim. Early in the novel, Jim's courage has failed him at a crucial moment. His strength of heart, both in terms of bravery and of forming serious attachments, is in question throughout the narrative, at least in his own mind. And at the end, he misjudges an enemy, and his miscalculation causes the death of his best friend, who happens to be the son of the local chieftain. Jim has promised this leader, Doramin, that if his plan results in the death of any of his people, Jim will forfeit his own life. When it does, he walks with great calm to Doramin, who shoots him through the chest. Jim glances proudly at the assembled crowd. "See, I am both brave and true to my word," and falls dead. Conrad doesn't perform a post-mortem, but there is one and only one place in the chest where a shot results in instantaneous death, and we know where that place is. The very next comment by Marlowe, the narrator, is that Jim was inscrutable at heart. The novel's all about heart, really, heart in all its senses. Jim's end, then, like the adamantine man's, is perfectly apt. A man who in life has put so much stock in heart, in loyalty and trust, in courage and fidelity, in having a true heart, can only die by a blow to the heart. Unlike Hawthorne's character's demise, though, Jim's is also heartbreaking. To the woman who is his de facto wife, to old Stein, the traitor who sent him in country, and to readers who come to hope for something heroic and uplifting, something suitably romantic for the incorrigibly romantic Jim. Conrad knows better, though. It's tragedy, not epic, as he proves by that shot in the heart. More commonly, though, heart trouble takes the form of heart disease. Vladimir Nabokov created one of the nastiest villains in modern literature in Lolita's Humbert Humbert. His self-absorption and obsession lead him to cruelty, statutory rape, murder, and the destruction of several lives. His darling Dolores, the Lolita of the title, can never lead a psychologically or spiritually whole adult life. Of her two seducers, Claire Quilty is dead, and Humbert is in jail, where he dies, somewhat unexpectedly, of heart failure. Throughout the whole novel, he's had a defective heart in the figurative sense, so how else could he die? He may or may not need to die, but if he does buy the farm, there's only one death symbolically appropriate to his situation. Nobody had to tell that to Nabokov. As a practical matter, then, we readers can play this two ways. If heart trouble shows up in a novel or play, we start looking for its signification, and we usually don't have to hunt too hard. The other way around, if we see that characters have difficulties of the heart, we won't be too surprised when emotional trouble becomes the physical ailment and the cardiac episode appears. Now, about that irony. Remember Florence and Edward, the wayward spouses with heart trouble? Just what, you ask, is wrong with their hearts? Not a thing in the world. Physically, that is. Faithlessness, selfishness, cruelty, those things are wrong, and ultimately those things kill them. But physically, their hearts are completely sound. So why did I say earlier they suffer from heart disease? Haven't I just violated the principle of this chapter? Not really. Their choice of illness is quite telling. Each of them elects to employ a fragile heart as a device to deceive the respective spouse, to be able to construct an elaborate personal fiction based on heart disease, to announce to the world that he or she suffers from a bad heart. And in each case, the lie is, on another level, absolutely true. As I said earlier, it doesn't get better than that.